Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Angela Merkel won her fourth term as German chancellor, but for the first time in Germany's post-war history, a far-right party managed to enter parliament. The anti-immigrant Alternative for Germany party won 12.6% of the vote. Today's guest, Eric Rigele, reports that Angela Merkel's victory has been marred by the far-right party. Eric Rigele is the European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. That's Canada's national newspaper. Eric covered the German election for the Globe and Mail, and he's based in Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. Great to have you back to explain to us what is happening in Germany. Before we do that, as we always do on the Media Roundtable, we like to highlight journalism that stood out this week. So what caught your attention?
What caught my attention was, since I have Germany on my mind still, even though the election finished 5 days ago, there's a very good explainer in The Guardian, which is widely read in the United States. It was a bit more subtle about why Alternative for Germany did quite well, and they did really well, especially in the former East Germany. The article's called Revenge of the East, How Anger in the Former East Germany Helped the AfD, and it was written by Philip Ultraman of The Guardian, and it appeared Thursday the 28th, so that appeared yesterday.
In yesterday's Guardian, we'll put a link to this at yourcallradio.org. What specifically did you like about this piece, Eric? What stood out for you?
Well, the British-Canadian-American press was a little bit hysterical in reporting about what happened in Germany. I'm sort of paraphrasing, but it was, rise of the fascists, rise of the far right. A couple of articles even talked about, the new Nazis. This article is a bit more subtle, and I would tend to agree with it. There's a lot of factors that explain the rise of Alternative for Germany, and most of its support comes in Eastern Germany. And why there? Because Eastern Germany is not nearly as wealthy as Western Germany. After reunification, the area is still underdeveloped compared to Western Germany, and there's a lot of resentment there. There's higher unemployment, and this comes out in the article. Of course, yes, there are some outright racists and xenophobes who support this party, but maybe not as many as you might imagine.
Well, before we dive in and talk about specifics, Eric, for people who are not familiar with how Germany's elections work, can you just give us a quick overview?
Okay, it's always a coalition government. In the last parliament, there were four parties. In this parliament, there are six parties. And it's too boring and technical to go into why it's always coalition governments, but it's the mechanics of the voting system. It's actually two votes. You vote for your local candidate, then you vote for a party list. And the combination makes it very hard to have non-coalition governments. I don't believe there's ever been a non-coalition government since World War II. So that's probably the main feature. So all these governments have to have form a partnership with one or two parties to actually govern. What's happening now is Angela Merkel, who lost a lot of votes compared to last time, she's busy trying to form a coalition, and she's trying to form a coalition with two other parties because she lost 1 million votes to AfD, the Alternative for Germany.
Talk a little bit about the political climate in Germany. You have written a couple stories about the youth vote, the low unemployment rate, and then, of course, what happened when Angela Merkel made the decision to bring in how many immigrants was it?
In 2015 and into 2016, it was about a million.
A million.
Actually, no one knows the exact number. It was mostly Syrians and some Afghanis, and that's when AfD, which was a small party in decline, which seemed completely irrelevant, that's when it turned around and became a xenophobic party, a party that went to the right. Before that, it was really interesting, Rose. It was a party, it seemed quite reasonable. I covered them before, And AFD was a party that was started by economists. So these were, you know, intelligent people who were worried about European bailouts. They wanted no European bailouts using German taxpayer money to keep Greece in the Eurozone. They just wanted Greece to leave. And that was the party right there. It was a Eurosceptic party. In 2015, it got taken over by the xenophobes and became an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Islam party.
And this party got started just 4 years ago?
Just 4 years ago. In the 2013 election, it didn't even make the 5% threshold to get into Parliament. It did pretty well a couple of years later in the European Parliament elections. This election, its vote went to almost 13%. Now, it was no surprise at all that they were going to get more than 5%. It was a big surprise that they did so well. They're the third biggest party in the German parliament, which is called the Bundestag, and that was a shock even to most Germans. It was no shock at all if they got in, but that they did so well was a shock to most Germans.
Tell us more about this party, Eric. The leader of this party, Alice Weidel, is a lesbian. She's a former Goldman Sachs economist. She has said Germany has become a safe port for foreign criminals. She's calling for Germany to withdraw from the Human Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. She says that minarets should be banned across Germany, headscarves worn by Muslim women in Germany's offices of public service should be banned. She's calling for the abolition of the current asylum law, which that party says is a product of Germany's overcompensation for Nazi-era crimes.
Oh, yeah, and there's more. But there's more. She's pretty extreme, but she hasn't got the most extreme views. Another prominent AFD leader who said that it's permissible for the border police to shoot immigrants as they cross the border. Mm-hmm. If you could imagine that, but they're not all crazy like her. I would say from the reports I read when I was in Germany and talking to my contacts there, probably, I don't know, let's say 20%. They're going to get about 90 or 100 seats in the Bundestag, in the German parliament. You know, probably 20 or 30 are extremely hard right. The rest are, you know, a combination of Eurosceptics, people who just want tighter immigration controls. To say the party is uniformly nutso anti-immigrant to the point they want immigrants shot at the border is not right, though certainly is a few of them like that.
Well, you were talking earlier about how the media are reporting on this party, and the PBS NewsHour had a piece about the ads that the AFD was running. They showed one billboard for the party featuring a pregnant white woman, and the message was "New Germans."
Yeah, and that was shocking. The message was that if we want more people in Germany, we can make them ourselves. We don't have to import them.
How does this party compare to other far-right parties in Europe, like Golden Dawn in Greece or the National Front in France, for example?
Well, Golden Dawn, that's another party I covered in Greece extensively. I mean, they are a neo-Nazi party. Their flag, their symbol is a stylized swastika. They don't disguise it. I think they're a bit closer to the Front National in France, which made it to the second round of the presidential elections in the spring, in the sense that they want border controls on immigrants. But the National Front, which is run by Marine Le Pen, is much more Eurosceptic than AFD is. Marine Le Pen wants out of the Euro and out of the European Union. You would describe AFD as a Eurosceptic party, but their policy is not really formed. I would suspect a lot of their members would just be quite happy to stay in the European Union.
Today we're speaking with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. That's Canada's national newspaper. Eric is based in Rome, and he covers Europe. He's been writing about the elections in Germany. Angela Merkel won her fourth term as chancellor, but for the very first time in Germany's post-war history, a far-right anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim party won 12.6% of the vote. If you have any questions for Eric about this, and then the broader questions, we're talking about this here in the United States. How are the media covering the rise of far-right groups here in the United States and in Europe? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What about that question, Eric? What strikes you about how the European press specifically is covering the rise of the right-wing parties across Europe?
Well, it's more surprising outside of Germany than inside of Germany. The thing about Germany, it's considered the most democratic country in Europe. It's considered the most politically stable country in Europe. Angela Merkel, who's been chancellor for 12 years now, she's on her fourth term, is considered the model of stability. She's considered the anti-Donald Trump, anti-Brexit. She, you know, very much in favor of Europe. She's anti-militaristic. I mean, she never got involved Germany never got involved in the Iraq war, and it's very, very reluctant all the time to send any troops overseas, even for peacekeeping missions. It supports NATO, but its NATO spending is way below the 2% of GDP guideline. So the country outside of Germany, no one could really understand. You would think that with this model democracy, model economy, it's got record low unemployment in Germany. It's about 5%, whereas in other countries like Spain and Italy, in France, it's 10 or 15%. In Greece, it's more than 20%. So what are the factors that gave rise to the questions being asked by the outside media? Is how could this be? We thought you lived in a paradise. And the answers are not that simple, but it is, yes, fear of immigrants, but you got to look where the AFD support is, and also the makeup of the German economy. There's a real wealth divide in the German economy, which surprises most Brits and Americans and Canadians, and it's the poorer people in Eastern Germany that are very much in support of AFD.
There was a good story in the New York Times about the wealth gap. And like you said, a lot of people quoted in the piece said that when people talk about Germany's economy, they don't talk about inequality in Germany like they do in other countries. Can you tell us more about that? And why doesn't that get more attention?
The inequalities, it's a good question, and I don't really know why. You got to remember, though, that Angela Merkel runs a pro-business government. It's a conservative pro-business government. It's, almost American-style Republican in nature. Germans are taxed, of course, more than Americans, and they have superb health care and superb education systems. But it is a pro-business government. You can tell that by, the light treatment of Volkswagen and the automakers in the Dieselgate scandal. Angela Merkel's government has been very protective of the auto industry. The point being that generally speaking, it's a pro-business government. And that has created a lot of favors for big business and the wealthy, and it's left a lot of people behind. So you do get a pretty extreme wealth divide that it has left a lot of people behind, especially in the eastern part of Germany. The other reason is why Germany is such a huge economic export success is that the Germans, since reunification two decades ago, have suppressed wages, and that's a huge issue in Germany. Germany is competitive because wages were kept down for years and years and years and years, and that allowed costs to go down, and that's another reason why the middle class and the poor are not as well off as you would think.
Hmm. The piece that I mentioned in the New York Times is called Merkel Says Germans Never Had It Better, But Many Feel Left Behind. Eric, you also write about why Germany's Social Democratic Party lost the youth vote. You report that Germany's youth voters are something of an anomaly in the EU, where young voters seem to be rebelling against the established or governing parties. There's no doubt that Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Britain's Labour Party, owes his political life to the youth vote. But things in Germany are different. Why is that? It's because, as you write, it's pretty easy for young people in Germany to find jobs.
Yeah, that's part of it. Also, young people couldn't really tell the difference between Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, the CDU, and the Social Democratic Party. It's called the SDP, which is run by Martin Schulz, who's the former president of the European Parliament. They thought it was, what is the point of voting for the socialists when the policies were pretty much identical to the CDU? And as an outsider, I must admit, I had a hard time telling the difference between Angela Merkel's conservatives and the SPD socialists, which of course were in a coalition government until a few days ago. So I think that's one reason. Another reason is that because unemployment is so low that young Germans, the youth, the university grads, don't have a lot to complain about. They are getting jobs, and they're getting good jobs. The people who are suffering in Germany are it's the older generation who are living in the more deprived eastern part of Germany. It's not so much the young and educated people.
In fact, in the New York Times piece, they quoted Helmut Richter, who's 59, and he works at a food bank. He said that when his organization opened 22 years ago, they served 300 people. In 2005, when Merkel became chancellor, they served 1,500. Today, they're serving almost 11,000, and 120 families are on a waiting list.
Yeah, well, you know, Rose. Also, you know, Germany is viewed as a great industrial power, and it is. But it's also suffered from deindustrialization as well. I mean, many factories, steel factories, coal mines have shut and migrated to Asia, to China, to Eastern Europe. So you do have some pretty severe deindustrialization happening in Germany, and again, it's hitting all of Germany, especially in the eastern part of Germany.
What about immigrants in Germany, Eric? Can you talk about? You said it's about 1 million people have arrived. What is life for immigrants like at this point?
Well, the Germans seem to have done a pretty good job at integrating them, and this is one of the mysteries to me, that, you know, if this federal election had been held in 2015, the AfD might have done even better. But, you know, this is 2 years after the immigration surge, and yes, there were two incidents in Cologne at the end of 2015. There were sexual attacks the very last day of December on German women. And then a year later, you had a Tunisian asylum seeker who rented a truck and drove through a Christmas market in Berlin, and he killed 12 people. Those are horrific, but, you know, there haven't been any other really horrific attacks. The integration seems to be going pretty well. When I was in Germany, in Berlin last week, I didn't get the sense that there was a lot of concern among the average Germans about the integration of all these immigrants. It doesn't seem to be a big issue anymore to me, though the AfD has made it a big issue and profited from immigration immensely in this election.
What about jobs and housing for immigrants? How's that working?
I think pretty well. The one thing that's going really well is education. A lot of thousands of teachers were pulled out of retirement and paid to teach these immigrants German. They have to be able to operate in an economy. And also, don't forget that Germany is depopulating very rapidly. The population is now about 80 million. in about 20 years. That number is, it's probably a bit wrong. 20 or 30 years, the population is going to drop to 65 million or so. The point being, it's a steady decline in population because it's such an aging population. Germany needs immigrants.
Hmm.
It really does.
Wow.
And a lot of these Syrians are very well educated and very skilled, and they are getting jobs.
So you're saying the population's going down because people are dying. They're aging and dying.
Yeah, I mean, it's a general European trend. It's actually worse in Italy, where I live, than in Germany. But it's very, very bad in Germany. So they do need immigration. And most Germans agree with that. They do need immigration. The youth vote went strongly in favor of Angela Merkel because young people are largely in favor of immigration. They're kids of the world. They understand the economy there. They understand that the economy, A, it can absorb immigrants, and B, needs them. Germany very much needs immigrants, as does Italy.
What about Afghans?
Does Germany need Afghans?
Well, no. According to some reports, they're deporting Afghans. I mean, obviously, it's a mixed bag where some cities are welcoming them with open arms. Some cities don't want them.
Well, what happened is in 2016, after this huge immigration surge, there was a backlash against Angela Merkel, and the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, started rising in the polls. It was down 5 or 6%, then it went up. I think it peaked at about 16 or 17%. And she got the message, and what she did was she tightened up the asylum rules, and they remain tight. There's not a lot of immigration now, not a lot of refugees coming into Germany. And on election night last Sunday, she actually said that she was very open about it. She was not happy about the result, even though she was elected chancellor again. She said that we have to take care of the concerns of the people. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have the quote exactly right. We have to take care of the concerns of the people who voted for AfD, which tells me that she's going to not open up the immigration doors again. She'll allow a few of them, but she's not going to allow a repeat of 2015.
You have written that the AfD's role will be limited to outspoken opposition, but that will make the parliament a lot noisier. It'll completely change the tone. Do you think it'll shift discourse to the right?
I do, but remember, they're not actually going to be in the coalition. The coalition will probably be formed by Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, with the Green Party, which I'm thrilled about, and by the Free Democrats, which is a pro-business party. So it's going to be a bit awkward. AfD, even though it's number three, is not going to be in government. It will not be leading any key committees. But with almost 100 members of parliament, it's going to be quite noisy. They're going to be quite harsh. And I think, given what Angela Merkel said on election night, that they have to, take into consideration the concerns of the AfD voters, that there will be a shift to the right. Now, what does that mean? I think the main thing is going to be immigration. I think there's no way they can open up the immigration floodgates again. Also, I think Angela Merkel is going to pretty much ignore Europe for a while. She's very big on European integration, working with Emmanuel Macron, the new French president, about the next step in the European project. I think that's going to disappear for a while on the Germany side, and she's got to take care of the forgotten areas of Eastern Germany, which means spending more money in the deprived areas.
Before we let you go, Eric, we have a question from a listener. Let's hear from Jake in San Bruno. Hi, Jake. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. Yeah, so I have a question for Mr. Reguli about Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister of Germany, and him leaving the post after nearly a decade of service.
Eric, can you hear?
I can only hear him barely. The question was about Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister, but I don't know what he wanted to know about him.
Jake?
Yeah, could you just kind of comment on his leaving after 10 years of service?
Oh, okay. Yes. That wasn't a big surprise to me. He's quite an old man. He's in his mid-70s. He's been a great ally of Angela Merkel's, but Angela Merkel, as I mentioned before, has to build a coalition government. To build a coalition government, you have to offer some key positions, cabinet positions, to the smaller parties, and it looks like to get one or the two of the smaller parties, then she's going to offer the finance ministry to, I imagine, the Free Democratic Party. So it's a strategic move. Also, I think that as Speaker of the Parliament, he's going to play a bigger role in keeping a lid on Alternative for Germany. He'll be probably in that role, be able to make sure they don't become a stronger party than they are.
Well, thank you for calling, Jake. Eric, what are you working on right now?
I'm not looking at Germany today. I'm going to probably go into what's happening in Italy. You know, you've got a rise of the populist party, the AfD, in Germany, and the same thing's happening in Italy. The five-star movement in Italy, which we should talk about in detail one day, is coming on very strong in Italy. It's a Eurosceptic populist party, and I think I'll write about them because Italy is the next big election, and there's populism is not dead in Europe by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, we'll definitely have you back for that. Eric, thank you so much for joining us, and have a good weekend.
Thank you very much, Rose.
Eric Reguli is the European Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail. That's Canada's national newspaper. He's based in Rome, and you can find the stories that Eric has written in the past couple weeks about Germany's election. And coming up after the break, we'll be joined by award-winning journalist Trudy Lieberman to talk about the Republican Party's latest failed attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And also, a very important point here, the administration is still working to gut the existing law. So I hope you can stay with us for that. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your Call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. There was a lot of coverage of the Republican Party's latest failed attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act and drastically slash Medicaid and subsidies. The bill is dead for now, but the Trump administration is gutting the existing law. This is very important and deserves a lot more attention. The enrollment period has been shortened, and the groups who sign up for insurance, there are so many here in California, such dedicated people who do this work to actually walk you through the process, they're going to lose 90% of their budgets. We're talking about media coverage with Trudy Lieberman, an award-winning journalist, past president of the Association of Healthcare Journalists, and a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Trudy also writes a bi-monthly column for Thinking About Health. What's great about this column is it runs in newspapers in rural parts of the country. Hi, Trudy. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose. It's good to be back.
Well, it's always great to have you, Trudy, to go over all this, these very important things about health care. The Graham-Cassidy-Heller bill, again, was a big bill. An estimated 32 million would lose coverage, according to the CBO. It would end Medicaid expansion that helped 11 million people gain coverage, cuts coverage for seniors on fixed income, kids, people with disabilities. Overall, it got so much media attention. What did you think about the coverage? And let's talk, make a distinction between broadcast and print.
Sure. I looked at the coverage in particular this past week for a piece that is up right now on the website of the Columbia Journalism Review about Medicaid. And when I started to look at this, I was really pleasantly surprised, actually, that so many newspapers, primarily in the parts of the country outside of the East Coast and the West Coast, were really covering this. I mean, it was very heartening to see this. And when I started reporting this, I found that it was actually a very big story in places like Arizona and Idaho, places where you really wouldn't think about reporters covering Medicaid. And so when I started talking to reporters and asking them about that, they said, well, this is really a big deal for us, and there is a lot of reader interest in this. And historically, when we've asked reporters to try to write about Medicaid, they've said, well, they'd like to, but their editors think it's not really what they want to write about, because readers don't want to read about poor people, and the advertisers are not interested in poor people as readers. That's not the demographic that they're looking for. And so a lot of coverage over the years had really never gotten written, except as it related to fraud in the Medicaid program. And as I point out, the fraud is largely perpetrated by providers, not the recipients on Medicaid. So I think what we've seen in this case is that because there is so much interest, the reporters have pretty much covered what Trump's plan would do in their states. And, of course, they would Medicaid would be decimated in most of these states.
You have a column about this, Medicaid's still a target of health care reform, and you report that Medicaid is the government's largest insurance program. It covers a whopping 74 million Americans. And this Graham-Cassidy-Heller bill would have ended Medicaid expansion that helped 11 million people gain coverage. Have you been able to ask Republicans, Trudy, why they are so intent on going after Medicaid?
No, I have not talked to them directly, but my guess is that the Washington reporters have probably tried to do that, and they all have these very standard pat answers. And we learned that in coverage of the town hall meetings earlier this year that the reporters pretty much just stuck to their talking point, not the reporters, the members of Congress, stuck to their talking points. So if you think about what a talking point might be for a member of Congress confronted by a member of the press, he or she might say, well, it's a very expensive program, which it is, and we can't afford it anymore, and we're going to come up with other ways to deal with this. And they're really not going to tell the real reasons why they might not want it, and that's that they wanted to cut the vast expenditures of this program for other uses. And I think that that has seeped out a little bit, that people are understanding those trade-offs. And then I think in the end that the only thing that mattered was to try to get the 50 votes. I think the humanitarian aspects of this and how families would be hurt, and children would be hurt, people on Medicaid who were relying on the program to pay for long-term care and nursing homes would be hurt. I don't think they were thinking about any of that. I don't think that was part of their rationale, their part of their thinking. They were just trying to think, you know, I'm a Republican, I don't like big government, I don't like this program. Sometimes the governors don't like this program, and so let's just change it in ways that it really will hurt people, but will accomplish other objectives.
And I appreciate, Trudy, that in the second paragraph of your piece about Medicaid, you write that the people who are most likely to be on Medicaid are the poor, the disabled, kids, and seniors who need it to pay for their nursing home care. And I'm guessing that, you know, if you're getting your health care from your employer, or if you don't struggle with this issue like so many people do, you might not know how important a program like Medicaid is. And I'm guessing a lot of people don't know that it covers 74 million citizens.
Well, I think that's right. I think they just sort of, they get Medicaid and Medicare always mixed up, because the two programs, of course, were passed at the same time in 1965 under the Johnson administration. So they kind of have a vague notion of what it does. They don't know its reach, but I think something has changed really in the past year. I think people who have employer-sponsored coverage, I think they're becoming more attuned to what the issues are in a way that I've really never seen before. They are struggling too, and many of them are struggling to pay deductibles that are reaching $8,000, $5,000, in addition to fairly high premiums. And so as some people I've interviewed over the years say, you know, this insurance is not really insurance if you have to pay so much out of pocket. And then there's all kinds of games that providers are paying in terms of the pricing, and so you really don't even know what you're paying. So I think as people who have, quote, good coverage are understanding that they, too, are being affected by some of these problems in the system, they're maybe becoming more sympathetic, I think, to people at the bottom, like the poor and the disabled and the elders in nursing homes, that, hey, you know, there's really a problem here.
Well, and once again, people with disabilities travel to Washington, D.C. to make their voices heard during the one hearing that Republicans were having about this bill. And once again, people were taken out of their wheelchairs. According to reports, about 50 people were arrested.
Yes, I saw those pictures. And I think the disability community is very vocal, and as it should be, and trying to be very protective of the law that was passed to help them, the Disabilities Act, but also many of these health care problems. And I think that in the piece that you referenced that's on the CJR website today, talks about a woman in Idaho who was receiving Medicaid. Idaho was a state that did not expand under the ACA. And the woman had cerebral palsy, and she was very afraid that she was going to lose that coverage, and said, I will be living under a bridge if this is taken away from me. And the idea was that she was using the money that she was getting from Medicaid to pay for her health care expenses, were enabling her to save whatever other income she had to maintain her living in an apartment. She wanted to live independently. And so what she saw this as a threat to her home, that if somehow she got kicked off this program, this would be a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. And she had approached the senator from Idaho and asked him, you know, can I come live with you if you do away with Medicaid? So I think people are kind of desperate, and I think they need this program. I mean, 74 million people are on it for a reason.
Wow.
And we have the children problem. A lot of children are insured under Medicaid. And if the states change their programs, there could be eligibility problems all up and down the line. And then that's another problem that is going to happen, even if the federal program stays pretty much intact.
Trudy Lieberman is an award-winning journalist, longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and she also writes a bimonthly column called Thinking About Health for the Rural Health News Service. The nice thing about this one is that it actually runs in newspapers in rural parts of the country where I'm guessing a lot of people don't have internet access, and that's a really important group to target and to reach out to. If you have any questions for Trudy, or if you have any comments about the latest bill from the Republicans and how it was covered. As we said earlier, the bill is dead for now, but the administration is still working to gut the existing law. If you have any questions about that, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about the media telling stories and really bringing in context about the health insurance industry and how it works? Facts. Also, I've been hearing just so many Republicans and Democrats throw out these lines, but I'm not sometimes not hearing reporters say, well, here's the fact on that. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. One of those lines, Trudy, is that Republicans often say Medicaid is going broke.
Well, they all say all these programs are going broke. I mean, they say that about Social Security. They say that about Medicare. That's sort of their standard line. And the reason why they're doing it is to sort of speed up passage of legislation that will cut these programs. But I think that requires a lot of examination. And I think in the context of the Medicare program now, this is the program for seniors over 65, Medicare does have some financing challenges going forward, only for the hospital payments, only for the hospital trust fund. And even if the worst happens, say in 15 or 12 years or whatever the projection is, and keep in mind those are only projections, they would still have enough money to pay out most of the benefits. There's a certain portion that they wouldn't. So going broke is not exactly the right language, but it's scary language, and I think people really glom onto that. As far as Medicaid is concerned, it is a very expensive program, and it's expensive because the benefits are very rich. It really does help people get coverage, and kids in particular, many benefits for children that are very, very helpful to them. And so the states in particular have been really worried about this because they've been saying for a long time that Medicaid is crowding out their share of what they have to spend on this that they could use on roads or education or other needs for their state. And it's good to remember here that Medicaid is financed jointly by the federal government and the states. So the states are complaining about their share is really high and it's crowding out other needs that the state may have. So there are changes going on in a few states now, and there may be more. And this is a threat to Medicaid, I think, down the road, even if Congress is not going to do anything more with the program. And we don't know what they might come up with later this year or next. But many states are applying for what we call waivers, and they are waivers from some of the federal benefits and give the states more leeway in changing their programs. And they talk about that in terms of more flexibility, more room to experiment. And so they're using all these really nice sounding words, and maybe to some extent that may be true. But what it also would do is change the way some people in those states would get benefits and the requirements. And if you look at Indiana, which is one of the states that currently has the waiver, the recipients on Medicaid are required to maintain a small health savings account, and the state funds a large portion of it, and then they're supposed to be able to use that account to pay for some of their smaller medical needs. The idea is that they need personal responsibility, and if you miss, and then they also have small copays that they have to pay, and one of the provisions says that if you miss a copayment over if you miss premium payments over several months, you will be locked out of coverage for a period of time. So these things can be very punitive. And I think that the Medicaid community and the advocates for these people are really worried about these waivers, because it is really saying to people that they may be second-class citizens when health care is concerned.
Mm. We have a few callers on the line, Trudy. Let's hear from Don in San Francisco. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for the show. I have a simple question. How much, if at all, will these repeated defeats of the Trump care bill affect the 2018 congressional elections?
Thanks, Don. Trudy, what do you think?
I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball. One pollster I talked to a couple of weeks ago thinks that health care is going to be a really big factor in the election. And he also told me that people are moving toward the principle that everybody should have health care.
Mm.
And we saw that a little bit in the town halls that the congressmen and women had throughout the spring, that the quotes that the papers would print were from people saying, well, I believe everybody should have health care. And I don't think we were seeing that later. So to answer the question, I would think that if the public is still engaged to the extent that it has been this year, I think it could be a real issue in the 2018 election.
Well, let's hope it is. Bernie Sanders was at the Yerba Buena Gardens earlier, I think it was last week, and I interviewed a number of nurses because the national nurses were in town for a conference. And it was really interesting to hear from nurses. I mean, it would be great to hear from people who actually work in healthcare to find out what they're facing right now and how things would change if we had a universal healthcare system. What solutions would they like to see? I mean, they're really the experts.
Well, I think one thing that's been lacking in the whole idea of another kind of a system, single payer, national health insurance, Medicare for all, whatever label you want to use, it would be a different kind of a system, more akin to what the Canadians or all of the European countries have. And so what that would mean is, in terms of the U.S., is really we don't know. We know that people are warming to the principle that everyone should have coverage, but as I wrote for another site, the Center for Health Journalism at USC last week, we have to decide two questions, and we're not there yet. And one of the questions is, what should this system look like? Because you can have a national system that's not single payer. Germany has one, Japan has one, other countries have them, and they work really very well. And Canada, to much of an extent, is not single payer either. It's a provincial system with the federal government putting money into the provinces. So there are other ways that you can produce a system. So one has to decide that, and then you have to decide the financing of the system. And that's the question, or two questions, cost control and financing the system. And we haven't been willing, and even the advocates of this change, potential change in the future, have not been ready or willing to address those two questions. And I think that at some point we may have to move away from principle and get to the fundamentals here. How would we actually control the cost of our system? Because that's the crux of the matter in the U.S. And how would we finance a different kind of system? And so I think the challenge for the nurses and anybody else who's very strongly advocating for this is to, you know, work toward details for the next time this comes up.
And we're definitely going to continue to do shows about details. Trudy, I wanted to ask you about a piece that Julie Rovner wrote, former NPR reporter who is now a reporter with Kaiser Health News, which is independent from the Kaiser Family Foundation. A very good piece about five looming challenges for the Affordable Care Act. And it's about how the administration is trying to really gut the existing law. And I just want to read her 5 points, and then I'd love for you to tell us what you think is most important. Insurers okay. still face tremendous uncertainty. The administration has cut funding for efforts to sign people up for insurance. The 2018 enrollment period is half the length of this year's, and it'll be shorter still. The Trump administration is dragging its feet on giving states flexibility to stabilize their markets, and then Republicans could take another shot at a full overhaul next year or even this year.
Well, I think all of those are excellent points that Julie makes, and I would agree with all of them, that the ACA is facing many challenges, and not the least of which is that those risk pools in many of the states are really kind of rocky. And the reason for that is that the insurers claim that they've had a lot of uncertainty and they didn't quite know how to price their products. But there's also been another thing going on here. A lot of companies that were selling in that market had a lot of sick people coming into those risk pools, and maybe some of them hadn't priced their policies quite right. Many of them, when the exchanges first came out, came in with very low prices to attract a lot of people, and many of them who came in were sick and they had problems, and of course they have to cover them because that's what the ACA does. And so I think in many states there is some problems with these exchanges, and we're already seeing this year, or the 2018 year, that the prices, the premiums, are really high in many, many states. I just saw a list of rate increases for the state of Florida, and they were huge, 48% from one carrier, an average premium increase. You know, I've never seen that wow. in all my years of covering it. So I think that is a serious issue, and how that's going to be solved, I don't know. There's a bipartisan commission committee in Congress working on this, and I think that they will coming to some kind of conclusion, and then they stopped working on it to see what would happen with the Graham bill, and I think they're going to resume again next week. So that may be a partial solution for a couple of years, the thing about the Trump administration shortening the enrollment period is could be catastrophic, because it takes people a long time to sign up, and many people, of course, do at the last minute, partly because it's hard work to go through those exchanges and doing all those, you know, stuff that you have to do on the internet and shopping. It's very time consuming, because I know I've tried it, so, and I've done stories about it. It takes a lot of work and effort. So people put it off and put it off, and then if they are having financial problems and they're worried about the prices they're going to have to pay, you know, they just may decide to go bail.
Wow.
Which would be even harder for those risk pools in terms of stability. So I don't think that that action by the administration helps at all.
What is the media's responsibility at this point, Trudy, to inform the public about these changes? Because, as you say, they're drastic.
Well, I think all of the news outlets need to start talking about the rate increases, which they sort of are, but they are talking about it in the abstract, and of course nobody pays the average rate increase. But I think they need to help people learn how to shop and to make the trade-offs with insurance, and I think everybody, whether they buy in the exchange or for their employer or wherever, need to understand there's some fundamental things you need to know, and you have to trade off. If you want a low premium, you might get very high deductibles and cost sharing, and vice versa. If you want to pay up front and a high premium, well, then you're going to have to pay less as you go forward. So it becomes down to a question of how risk averse any family or any person is. Mm. Do you want to pay up front or do you want to pay later?
And Trudy,
takes a gamble.
We have just a couple of 30 seconds left, but the LA Times reported in July that California rates will rise about 13% this year. That's more than three times the increase of the last 2 years. And what you hear Republicans say, rightly so, is that premiums are so unaffordable for so many people. And I just wish that a reporter would say, all right, well, then why don't you pass a cap?
Well, the problem is they're going to keep going up because we're not controlling the underlying price of the care. And that message is not really getting out to the public. You know, insurance companies are just a pass-through, if you really want to look at it. It's not them that are setting the price of MRI, really. It's the doctors and the hospitals. And so, yeah, they negotiate, but they're passing through the cost. And until we have a way as a country to deal with that, I think we're going to keep seeing this, and people are going to continue to be unhappy.
Trudy Lieberman is a longtime contributor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and she writes the bimonthly column Thinking About Health for the Rural Health News Service. Trudy, thank you so much for all the information, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our intern. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.